Well, this started with Lipscomb celebrating their 125th anniversary last October. And so I said to John, do you want to teach next year at Pepperdine and just talk about 125 years of history or the impact of Lipscomb and Harding? And then that led me to Shelley, who is the new archivist for the Disciples of Christ Historical Society. So that's our class tomorrow. And I thought we would talk about moving all that archives out of Nashville, which happened last summer, over to a new building at Bethany between the Campbell Mansion and the college. And so we'll have plenty of slides and images, I think. You got a PowerPoint. And then once I had those two down, I've always wanted to just reflect on how many colleges grew out of the Stone Campbell movement. And Claude Spencer told me one time it was over 500. Now that I've been researching, he's definitely right. So I can't begin to touch on 500 tomorrow, but I'm just going to pick up a few favorites. So that's on Friday. So today we have John Mark Hicks. Our topic is the 125th birthday anniversary of Nashville Bible School, 1891, and the impact of Lipscomb and Harding on Christian colleges and this heritage. John is professor of theology at Lipscomb and a favorite here at Pepperdine. He's been on this program many, many times. So welcome John Mark Hicks back to teach for us at this hour.
Well, this is a difficult topic to try to cram into 45 minutes. But I want to try to do this in like 35 and give you opportunity to ask questions or make comments. And I thought I would kind of focus on the origins of the Nashville Bible School and say a little bit about how it, shall we say, birthed, in one sense, a movement among churches of Christ. Now, education, of course, predates Nashville Bible School in the Stone Campbell movement. I mean, Bacon College and Bethany College and all sorts of colleges, right? Many of which did not survive. Very long. Bacon College didn't survive very long, for example. But what happened in the Nashville Bible School at Lipscomb, what is now called Lipscomb, in Nashville, had not only a continuous impact of 125 years, but it spawned what I would call a Bible school movement that impacted churches of Christ worldwide. And I'll say a little bit about that. But I want to get to the origins as a primary focus and philosophy. Origins and philosophy. So the first hint we get of at least a public hint of a school is this little piece by J.C. McQuitty, who, of course, McQuitty Printing Company and so on, basically continued the gospel advocate. And you can see he says here that Nashville deservedly has the title the Athens of the South. While others have the finest educational facilities here, our people have not a single school in the city under their control. And I mean, that's at all educational levels that we're talking about. And so there's this, I think he's kind of tilling the ground a little bit, because the origins of Nashville Bible School are actually in 1889 when Lipscomb and Harding had a conversation. Harding was present in the city he was present to debate a Baptist, and he held a meeting, a very successful meeting, a 7-week meeting, which many were baptized, and they had a conversation about a school. And Harding said, well, I can't do anything about that because I'm already booked a year and a half. So in 1891, maybe we could start something. And that's what they decided to do. If you notice, he talks about our brother. He's talking about Lipscomb there. Our brother is certainly in earnest about this matter. He proposes to give 10 acres of beautiful ground out about 3 miles from the city. He says the ground is as beautiful as the Vanderbilt campus. And he's right about that. Beautiful rolling hills in that area of southern, wouldn't have been Nashville proper at that time, but he would deed all the land to the college eventually. Now the schools in Nashville at the time, Vanderbilt, which is Methodist, University of Nashville, Peabody Normal School, which is kind of a more secular institution, which is now part of Vanderbilt. Belmont College, which is Baptist. Cumberland University, which is Presbyterian. Then what became American Baptist College, which is African American, and Fisk, which is African American, and McHarry, which is Medical College, African American. All these schools were present in Nashville in 1890. And you can see what McQuitty says, there's not a school under our control. Yeah, just think about the language under our control. I don't know, you know, what all you could read into that, you know, under our control, but not one associated with us is kind of the thought, right? So, there's Lipscomb and Harding in one of their famous pictures. Harding is the one on your right, and Lipscomb's the one on the left. This was the purpose. This is from the Gospel Habit in 1892. While therefore the Nashville Bible School proposes to teach the languages, arts, and sciences as they are taught in the great schools of this city, while by the grace of God it expects to be behind none of them in teaching whatsoever is necessary to make men and women useful and successful citizens, it proposes above all things to teach the Word of God as of infinitely more importance than all these other things. So you can hear kind of a dual purpose, right? To equip, and then to, you got a question?
Could you point at Harding, please?
This is Harding.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's Harding. This is Lipscomb.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem. You can hear the dual purpose. Equip citizens, equip them for life as a citizen, and to facilitate that and ground that, and to more fundamentally shape the character, the moral character, by teaching the Bible. So our effort in the Bible school, Lipscomb says, is to give Bible teaching its true importance in education, to train children to be better, truer Christians. We are doing what we believe should be done in teaching every child, whether he intends to farm or merchandise, preach the gospel, or practice medicine. So the original intent is not to train preachers. The original intent is to shape character, to develop character. And out of that character, formed by biblical teaching, formed by practices of spiritual life in community, to form a character that then is, by that character, empowered to become and to be in the community in whatever profession they may choose, whether it's education or medicine or preaching. A cultured education. I think this is one of the more interesting things about the beginning of Lipscomb, of Nashville Bible School. Lipscomb is a farmer. His roots come from farming and agriculture. He was not, he's certainly an educated man at Franklin College, had a BA. Harding went to Bethany. Harding had a BA from Bethany. So they were both interested, they were both educated people. But what Lipscomb was also interested in, and Harding as well, was kind of the culture of the school was not the high life of the society, but that the culture of the school should serve the poor. And he does this by an implicit contrast between what Vanderbilt does and what Nashville Bible School does. So listen to this language. He says, it is the purpose of the trustees of the Nashville Bible School to always maintain it as one in which all students can receive. It shall have a thorough literary education which will fit them for any station in life, one in which all will be trained in gentle manners, real refinement, notice real refinement, and true culture, which are also essential to the true gentleman and lady, and above all else, one in which from the Word of God itself will be daily taught the correct principles of life, which will prepare its students for usefulness and good. There is that which is called polish, which only veneers selfishness, vanity, and all animal appetites. But this is not genuine refinement and true culture. True culture produces as fruit the greatest good in one's life. There are plenty of fashionable schools for young ladies, for instance, in which they can receive all the polish and culture necessary to give them ease and grace of manner in polite society. But the schools in which, with this polish, ease, and grace of manner, they receive also a thorough training and development in true and sacred principles which are so necessary to equip them for their real life mission are few. You can hear kind of the contrast. Okay, this is the Athens of the South. Vanderbilt, I think who he's naming here, because recently Vanderbilt has gone through some shifts in this period of time. It's a very cultured place. It's an elitist place. It's a place where people learn true society, right, and how to be in polite society, which Lipscomb regarded as just, as he says here, a veneer for selfishness and for one's own self-aggrandizement, right? What Lipscomb wants to do is to inculcate true culture. And true culture is not about selfishness, but it's about mission. It's about participating in mission. Being a part of the mission of the kingdom of God, you might say. And that contrast is really important for the beginnings of the Nashville Bible School. And I think it's also that contrast that is part of the beginnings of a lot of the schools in the early first 20 years after Nashville Bible School begins. This is part of the daily Bible teaching movement. Right? Every day the Bible is going to be taught. Now what that means is not that there's some kind of legalism about daily Bible. It's rather the way education was done in the early 20th century or late 19th century, that you had daily lessons, for example, daily lessons in English or daily lessons in literature or daily lessons in Greek. These were recitations, daily recitations. So those subjects were taught daily. And if the Bible is going to be a subject alongside the other subjects, then the Bible is not something relegated to chapel one time a week or even every day. The Bible is not something that you just use in devotional life. But the Bible becomes an academic subject. Not for the sake of academics, but for the sake of character formation. And so there's going to be a daily recitation of the Bible, which I think Lipscomb intended, but what was intended by that is not that we absolutely have to have the Bible every day, but it's rather that the Bible is going to be treated just like other subjects. It's going to be studied just like you study French or you study English or you study math. You're going to study the Bible. But the purpose of studying the Bible is character formation. Right? And I think that is that becomes part of the heart and soul of the Bible school movement. It's a liberal arts program, which at the heart of the liberal arts program is a dedicated study of the Bible for the sake of character development. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the first point here. I'm going to suggest three things shape the Nashville Bible School and its children, you know, in the first 20 years or so. The Bible as the educational ground of a meaningful, simple, wise, moral, and useful life as a human being, and particularly participating in the mission of God. So let's look at a few examples here. Here's from the school catalog, published. This extract was published by Harding in the Gospel Advocate. Our school is not intended for church members alone. Nor is it run simply to make preachers. We want to teach to boys and girls, men and women, what they need to know to make them wise, useful, and happy. No school, college, nor university in the South has a fuller course or a more diligent, painstaking set, a faithful set of students. Our motto is through work, whatever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. Notice that, to make them wise, useful, happy. That's about character formation. It's not a professional school, right? It's not, okay, go to school to learn this technique, or go to school to learn this technology, or to learn how to farm. It's go to school in order to be formed into human, authentic human beings who can live out that life in whatever profession they may choose. There's the sense of the Nashville Bible School grew out of the belief that the Bible ought to be one of the textbooks studied daily. Well, it's a textbook. You know, just like English has a textbook, and literature has a textbook, and math has a textbook, character formation has a textbook called the Bible. This is kind of that broad liberal arts notion here. As a literary school, in point of thoroughness and the amount of work done by both teachers and students, is equal to the best and is surpassed by no school in the state. While it is far superior to the great majority of schools in this regard, it is also know that besides the work done in literary departments, all students recite daily one or more lessons from the Bible, while they are trained in the daily practice of Christianity insofar as they will voluntarily receive such training. Christianity is practical, being daily submission to Christ in the school, in the home, and in every walk of life. In other words, the study of the Bible is an academic discipline alongside other academic disciplines. But the point of studying the academic discipline of the Bible is not head knowledge. It's about character and wisdom. It's what some theologians today talk about in terms of purpose of theology. Purpose of theology is wisdom. So we know how to be in the world in a way that participates in the mission of God. I think that that's kind of at the core of this early school. So, it's the second primary development then, or purpose, or context, is to equip devoted young people in order to supply the need for Bible teachers and effectively help the church. All right, so it's character formation, study the Bible, character formation, liberal arts, equip them to live in the world in a wise way, useful way, happy way, but also to help the church. So there's a great need in all the land, Harding says, of evangelists, elders, deacons, and Bible teachers. Our school is designed to help supply this need. We hope the churches will encourage their young men to attend, and they will, when help is needed, help them to come. So, in fact, at the end of October 1891, when the school had its first session, like October 3rd, 1891, at the end of October, they had 19. 14 of them were planning to preach. So even though the original design was not just to train preachers, that was who came right off the bat. Right? But it quickly expanded beyond that. And in the second year, included women. And, you know, then it took off in terms of the liberal arts and the function of Bible there. In 1896, here, this is from the Nashville American, the local newspaper in Nashville. When I was looking through the Nashville papers to see what announcements there were about, Harding gave a speech at the graduation exercise, and the paper reported that the young preachers trained in the school had led 1,400 people into the church and had established 10 new congregations within the last year. And that since the school's establishment 5 years ago, its graduates have led not less than 3,400 souls into their communion and have established not fewer than 28 churches. So this is kind of mission-oriented stuff that Harding particularly had in mind. But Lipscomb as well. But Harding really emphasized this dimension of the school as an aid to the church, to feed the church workers, workers that would then become either evangelists, or they would become school teachers and teachers in the church, or they would become farmers and plant churches. And even though the paper here reports this as young preachers, Harding's vision was much greater than just young preachers. His vision was a farmer who would plant a church, or who would bring in an evangelist to plant a church, and then become an elder in that church and help it. But you can see kind of the missional activity that's part of the concern here. When Lipscomb addressed the graduates in 1897, the newspaper summarized his speech as well. Quite an amazing thing, the newspaper's picking this up. I mean, Vanderbilt's a huge school at this point already, but Nashville Bible School, you know, we're talking in the 1890s, usually by the end of the 1890s, 100 students, something like that. And here's what he said that really goes to the heart of this missional dimension that shapes the early Nashville Bible School. He said, "Self-denial was the only way to be happy." And just think about that statement. Self-denial is the only way to be happy. You don't put that on a television advertisement. Right? You know, consumption is the way to be happy. Happiness is about consumption. Lipscomb is shaping what he thinks is at the core here of what he's trying to do in terms of character development. Even though the paper says this is about preachers, he doesn't think it's just about preachers. Lipscomb's very clear that this isn't about preachers. In fact, Lipscomb is not all that enamored with preachers in the sense of located preachers who stay in one place. He likes evangelists who go out and plant churches and let elders and members handle the work of the church. So this is a newspaper report, which I think is probably a little skewed. Because reading Lipscomb in other contexts, Lipscomb doesn't think this way about preachers alone. He thinks this way about all believers. So that, he said, self-denial was the only way to be happy, the mission of all preachers. I think you should read there, all believers, should be to go among the sick and lowly. That's that missional character that's a part of the early Nashville Bible School. So, three guiding motivations. We've talked about two of them. The first guiding motivation is the Bible as a textbook that provides character formation. The second is to help the church, to participate in the mission of the church, to supply workers for the harvest, you might say, to equip workers for the harvest. And workers for the harvest are not just preachers. They are school teachers and doctors and farmers and so on. But the third one, and this is, wow, this is the one that I wish, all of these I'd like to capture as a part of Christian universities and Christian education. But the third one is a little more difficult in the current context. A vision of the ministry of Jesus that includes and privileges the poor. Watch how this plays out for Lipscomb and Harding in terms of the Nashville Bible School. Harding says, this is in 1897, "We differ from other schools as to our teaching in that we teach the Bible to every student. They do not. We differ from many other schools in that we freely admit all who are not able to pay free of charge. Our master preached the gospel to the poor. We are trying to imitate him." That's an interesting statement, isn't it? Now, this doesn't mean they admitted everybody who applied or who could come. It's because there were physical limitations as to how many they could have. The facilities only allowed so many. But they did admit people who could not pay. We actually have stories about this. John T. Lewis, for example. John T. Lewis, who ultimately was one of the leading ministers in Birmingham, Alabama, in the mid-20th century, and in the early 20th century, helped plant so many churches around Birmingham, Alabama. He was one of these who came to school when he couldn't pay. And the thought was, if you can't pay now, then pay later. Kind of like a school loan, but no written debt. And if you can't pay later, just do the work of the kingdom. And that will be fine. That kind of thinking played itself out in several different students, some pretty significant people who became significant or became prominent, I should say. Not significant, that's not a good word. Prominent in the history of Churches of Christ. But notice the root of it. Our master preached the gospel to the poor. So will we. We are a school for the poor. Nashville Bible School basically says. David Lipscomb, 1903, the gospel is to the poor, for the poor, and they are the chief helpers of God in carrying forward his work in the earth. It is wrong for them to wait for or expect the rich to do it. It would do them good to do this work chiefly themselves. The school is for the benefit of the common people. That's a pretty radical way of understanding what's going on in the educational institution. You know, this is 12 years out. The school's been there for 12 years, almost 12 years by this time. But it's still kind of at the heartbeat of Lipscomb. And, you know, Harding has already started another school by this time, Potter Bible School. But it's still at the heartbeat of the institution to think, this is about the poor. This is for the poor. This isn't Vanderbilt. We're not Vanderbilt. We're not a school that benefits from the robber baron. Right? In fact, Lipscomb was very strong in his articles about the industrialist and the corporations. And he was a pro-labor gentleman. Right? Pro-labor. And I think you saw the school as kind of you could almost characterize it as a protest movement against the wealth and elitism of Vanderbilt. But it was more than that. You know, it wasn't just that. It was more than that. And I think that's part of it. I think that's part of what's going on here. When a student cannot, this is in the catalog. I mean, it's 120 years ago, right? I mean, so it's hard to say, let's just pick this statement up and put it in catalogs today. You know, it's a different world. It's a different context. Different factors are involved. But this illustrates it. When a student cannot pay tuition and his friends cannot or will not do it for him, we receive him without it, with the understanding that he will pay it without interest as soon as he becomes able to do so. If he never becomes able, our service to him is a gift. That's pretty astounding. Practically unimaginable today. Right? I don't know what to do with that. How do we keep that heartbeat at the center of a school that has that kind of we are for the poor institution? I don't know how to do that. I'm not sure. But I think it's something to seriously think about. How do we have that heartbeat? Certainly important to Lipscomb and Harding. No student is required, I keep saying this in different places, no student is required to pay anything to attend the school any more than a church member is required to give into the Lord's treasury when he comes into church. Our students are taught they ought to pay at least as much as $5 per month tuition. Well, that tells you there's a different world, right? If they are able. If they are not able, they are just as welcome without it. We do not... Wow, there's a typo. We do not dun our students. We what?
That's an old word.
Oh, okay. That's right. It is an old word, isn't it? That's right. I'm glad you reminded me of that. We do not dun our students. We present no bills unless they ask for them. They themselves settle the question as to whether or not they will pay tuition.
Wow.
You know, how can a school survive on that kind of basis? Well, I mean, Nashville Bible School, that was, there were times when it almost didn't survive. Right? And Potter Bible School did not survive because it had the same policy. After Harding became, suffered from dementia and had to stop teaching and leading the Potter Bible School, Potter School died. Yeah.
125 years, $105 be in today's money?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think you'd have to, yeah. I mean, there's a website where you can actually do that. You can put in $5, $18.91, and it'll tell you what the equivalency is. I imagine it's not close to what tuition is today, you know, in terms of what the equivalency is. I imagine that's pretty cheap tuition even for that time. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, $500 a year was a good amount of pay for a working man back at that time.
Okay. So if you think of an annual salary of $500.
So yeah. You're multiplying by 100 or something.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good benchmark there. And, yeah, I didn't think about calculating that out, but there are places, there are websites where you can calculate that out. Yeah. But understand what the heartbeat there is. You know, we're not a for-profit institution. We are a for-the-poor institution. And that's kind of what shapes the early Nashville Bible School. So here's kind of the philosophy. It is a fact that many young men who want to attend the school cannot pay tuition and board. In some cases, congregations send and sustain them, and others, individuals, have done it. Some have worked their way through. They had a farm. They could work on the farm. And, you know. In fact, what is it? What is the institution that is still... It's a Mennonite institution where they work a farm as part of their...
Ozark College.
Huh?
Ozark College.
Is it Ozark College does that? Okay.
Berea still has a farm as well.
Berea does? Okay. In no case has a young man properly commended to us been turned away because he lacked means. They may have lacked space, but they didn't. But not one because of means. And anyone, male or female, wishing to study the Bible will be received in the school. Now, watch where all this comes from. I think it comes from this heartbeat of Lipscomb that goes back to the post-Civil War era. This concern for the poor, which I think more deeply, the Civil War had a tremendous impact on Lipscomb, particularly regarding the poor. And we see this in the collection that he's taking up. He's asking the churches to help. He's appealing to the northern churches to help the South, to help their brothers and sisters in the South. And ultimately, he does take up a collection of over $100,000.
Wow.
Yeah. But most of the $100,000 comes from below the Mason-Dixon line and below the Ohio River. Wasn't a whole lot of support from, shall we say, the Yankees. Right? Most of it came from the South. But this is in that context. This statement occurs. Jesus, as Christ, sacrificed his honors, glories, joys, and possessions in heaven to help poor, helpless, fallen man on earth. This was the fellowship of God to man. I will give of my honors and joys to you, and take of my your weaknesses, sufferings, and sorrows to myself, is the language of Jesus to man in his mission to the earth. Our fellowship for one another must be of this character. The man who can spend money in extending his already broad acres while his brother and his brother's children cry for bread. The woman that can spend money in purchasing a stylish bonnet merely to appear fashionable while her sister is shivering with cold are no Christians, notwithstanding they have been baptized for remission of sins. You know, that's part of the... I want to use the word animosity, but I don't know if that's the right word. It's part of the tension in the post-Civil War South, where Lipscomb did not participate in the war. Right? He was a conscientious objector. And when, after the war, he appeals to the same states that sent guns to the South in the form of soldiers, these same brothers and sisters will not send money to the South. You know, they send preachers with Bibles. There's a little article where he says, send bread, not Bibles. You know, and so that's part of the tension. You know, there are deep sociological, but I also think theological reasons why there's this emerging tension and division, and part of it has to do with Lipscomb's deep sense of mission to the poor. So we see this in terms of the Bible school. The gospel is to the poor, for the poor, and they're the chief helpers. We've already seen that, so I won't go on there. Now, but those three ideas permeate some other schools. What happens, the New Nashville Bible School, basically they said, go do this in other places. That's why Harding would do it just an hour, well, an hour now, but, you know, 70 miles north of Nashville, something like that, maybe 60 miles north of Nashville, in Bowling Green, Kentucky. He thought, the more schools, the better. Because Harding did not have this image of schools becoming thousands of people. He had this image of schools being 100, 200, that would be focused on the ministry of the church and character development of children and young people as they grew up, and sending out these young people who would then establish schools. It wasn't this grand university system that he had in mind. It was more this local, hard-working, poor-oriented institutions to shape young people in communities. And what happened was these students went out and, you know, Potter Bible School in Bowling Green, Beansville Bible School in Ontario, the Nova Scotia, Armenia, Odessa, Missouri, Cordell, Oklahoma, Harper, Kansas, Tokyo Bible School in Japan, and others we could list. You could put Abilene up there as one of the, J.P. Sewell, who was a graduate of the Nashville Bible School, is the one who kind of encouraged the beginning of Abilene, what we now know as Abilene. So the others you could put up there. But all of these had that same daily Bible kind of thing. They all had, in their beginnings, all had this kind of orientation to the poor, participation in the mission. They were all liberal arts colleges. They were not Bible colleges in the sense that the only major is Bible. They were liberal arts colleges. And this is kind of the uniqueness of Churches of Christ, in one sense. That in the era of the fundamentalist-modernist debate, when, for example, independent Christian churches typically started Bible schools or Bible colleges, where the major only is Bible, and the purpose is to supply workers for the church, the Christian Churches of Christ typically had a much broader sense of what education was about. It was about moral development. It was about a broad sense of equipping people for wisdom and useful service in the kingdom, not just simply preachers. Although preachers and workers in the church are a part of that as well.
We have about 5 minutes. Do you want to do Q&A?
Yeah, let's do Q&A. I mean, I have a section here on African Americans, but would like to do that. But yeah, let's see what questions we have.
Well, the Nashville Bible School Does it relate to the current church, the Christian church?
No, Nashville Bible School is now Lipscomb University. That has a 125 continuous history in Nashville, Tennessee.
But did it, the history of the Christian church, did it come out of that college, or it was before there was already this church?
Oh, well, I mean, Churches of Christ, yeah, existed. Churches of Christ existed in Nashville, and two leaders in Churches of Christ, Harding and Lipscomb, started the school. Yeah. So the school, the churches were already there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Did the faculty at Nashville Bible School, was there payment? Like, I know something about how it was at Potter.
Yeah.
And if they didn't have the money, they didn't get paid, right?
The
faculty bore part of the burden.
Yeah, they were part of the mission of the school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it that way at Nashville?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, faculty would also be doing other things, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like, one faculty member was a doctor, so he could practice medicine as well as teach at the school to earn extra income. And then some people, like Harding, and would spend their summers in evangelistic work and, you know, that kind of thing. So there are other ways of doing that. Yeah.
Is there a quick synopsis of what's going on with African
Americans? Yeah, I can do that. You know, what Lipscomb was very concerned that African Americans had some educational opportunity. And, of course, in Nashville, there were three higher schools of higher education for African Americans. And so Lipscomb, from the very beginning of the Nashville Bible School, was also interested in providing some way to educate African Americans. Now, he couldn't do it in the school because Tennessee had a law that said that mandated segregation. I even have a, let's see, you know, there's a, I don't know if you know this fellow, Atticus Haygood. He was an African-American leader in the Methodist Church in Nashville in the 1870s. He wrote a book called Our Brother in Black. And basically he said, coming out of Nashville and out of Georgia, he said, only lunatics and visionaries would seek to integrate education in the South. So with that reality, which we could critique that reality, and we should, but that reality meant we needed separate schools for African Americans. And Lipscomb was very much always on the ground floor of finding funding for that. So we have the Silver Point Institute that is, what, an hour west? No, hour east of Nashville. We had an aborted beginning of another, the Practical Southern Practical Institute in Nashville. I don't know if you know that story. It's a sad story where there was funding for an African-American school and G.P. Bowser was going to be the principal or vice principal. They appointed a white man as the head, the principal. And they had a building. They actually bought a building downtown Nashville. And this is 1920. So this was going to be a school for African-Americans in Nashville, Churches of Christ. But the white superintendent, Brother Doris, thought it would be improper for the African Americans to enter the front door, and said they need to go in the back door. And Bowser said, we're not going to do that. And so that school lasted 3 months. And it wasn't until 1941 that then Marshall Keble started his institute with funding from patronage from, you know, A.M. Burton and some other white supporters, which itself had a sad ending as well. Yeah. So I think for Lipscomb, there was a concern to provide, but the opportunity was not as apparent. Yeah. Much, shall we say, much to the regret and the sadness for the church that that was true. And there's one sense in which you could say African American Churches of Christ started in Nashville out of the Jackson Street Church, which is where Keeble came from. And it was out of that church then that these institutes were started, connected to that church. It's a long story. If you don't have the book yet, if you've never read the book by Wes Crawford, Shattered Illusions, he tells that story. Wes Crawford, Shattered Illusions. He tells that story. As well as, what's the brother's name, Jerry, who wrote the Undying Dedication?
Vernon Boyd.
Yeah, Vernon Boyd wrote that biography of G.P. Bowser, right? Undying Dedication, where you'll hear that story there as well. But thank you very much. I appreciate your kind attention.
We'll be here tomorrow, same time. Shelley teaches tomorrow, and we'll also be here on Friday, 3:30 to 4:15 in this room. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.